tracks that the participants would sign in early 2001, he emailed some proposed language to Bob O'Neill, writing, "You might want to refer this to your legal people before we use it." The following day, O'Neill wrote back to say that he was working on the wording of the contract and would run it by the university's lawyers. But in the end, it appears, he never did. A lawyer would probably have advised him that the contracts should specify that any guarantee of confidentiality they might contain would not necessarily be able to protect the archive from a court order. The contract that each participant signed did not contain any such qualification, and no lawyer at Boston College ever reviewed those agreements. Hatchie ended the conference call on an upbeat note, like a team captain breaking up a huddle, as though the men would brace themselves and march into this battle as a team. But while they would exchange a few further emails, that was the last time that Hatchie or O'Neill would speak to any of their partners in the Belfast project. Before the end of May, Boston College turned over the Brendan Hughes interviews on the grounds that Hughes was now dead and much of the content of his oral history had already been published in Maloney's book. But whereas Voices from the Grave had been carefully edited to shield certain identities for legal and security reasons, the Hughes transcripts and recordings were unredacted. Maloney was irate to learn that the PSNI had come into possession of this material. "The authorities now have information upon which to act," he emailed Hatchie. "I would bet the mortgage that at this moment there are teams of lawyers working in the bowels of the British government trying to discover ways to force BC to surrender the names of other possible interviewees." Maloney proposed that, in order to avert a huge disaster, Hatchie and O'Neill should immediately pack the entire archive into FedEx envelopes and send it overnight to Markers in Ireland. Boston College might not have the stomach for a protracted legal fight, but Markers did. Before he would ever turn the tapes and transcripts over, Maloney said, Markers would happily go to jail. For the academics to send the material out of the country at that point might have constituted obstruction of justice. But Markers agreed with Maloney that Boston College had a moral obligation to honour its commitment to confidentiality, and this preempted any niceties of law. People had risked their lives to entrust their stories to the Belfast Project. The least Boston College could do was engage in a little civil disobedience to protect them. Now that the authorities had the Brendan Hughes material, Maloney predicted, there was a strong possibility that they would return with a second subpoena, seeking other interviews based on what they had gathered from Hughes. In a terse email, Hatchie said that under no circumstances would the university transfer the documents out of the country. In a line that would come to seem ironic in retrospect, he pointed out that promises had been made to the participants and argued that the safest place for their recollections was Boston College. The university agreed to fight the Price subpoena, arguing in a motion to federal court that releasing the material would violate the agreements made with the participants, undermine academic freedom, jeopardise the peace process in Northern Ireland, and throw into danger the lives of people associated with the project. The IRA imposes a code of silence akin to the concept of a murta in the mafia, the brief noted. As such, people like Dolores Price were willing to participate in the oral history only with the assurance that the interviews would be kept locked away. In an affidavit, Maloney noted that it is an offence punishable by death for IRA members to reveal details of their paramilitary careers to outsiders. But the US government hit back aggressively with its own arguments for why the Price interview should be handed over, suggesting that Maloney, McIntyre, and Boston College had made promises that could not be kept, that they would conceal evidence of murder and other crimes until the perpetrators were in their graves. The Belfast Project was not a work of journalism, and as a legal matter, there was no academic privilege that would shield the interviews from a court order. As for Maloney's arguments about the dangers of revealing the archive, the government argued Maloney himself had widely publicized the project. He published a book about it. Nobody had assassinated Makkers when it was revealed that he had interviewed Brendan Hughes and others for the project. So how dangerous could it really be? The government also suggested, erroneously, that the Price interview had already been unsealed and shared with the reporter Kieran Barnes for his article in Sunday Life. Lawyers for Boston College pointed out in a filing to the court that this was false, that US officials had clearly been duped by the ruse with which Barnes implied that he had heard the Boston tapes without ever saying explicitly that he had. But by August, Maloney's dire prediction had come true, and a second subpoena arrived at BC, demanding any and all tapes related to the abduction and death of Mrs. Jean McConville. In December, a federal judge ruled against the university and ordered BC to hand over the tapes and transcripts to the court for review. The university chose not to appeal this ruling, a capitulation that Maloney and Makkers greeted with ire, if not surprise. So the two Irishmen hired their own lawyers and appealed the decision. Unfortunately for the Irishmen, the legal case was cut and dried. There were few legal or constitutional protections that the men could invoke. But in parallel with their efforts in the courts, Maloney and Makkers, along with Carrie Toomey, pursued a political strategy appealing to anyone they could for support. John Kerry, then a senator from Massachusetts, had close ties to Boston College, where he received his law degree, as well as to Ireland. Kerry wrote to the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, urging her to work with British authorities on the issue, because the subpoenas might jeopardize the peace process. The Massachusetts branch of the American Civil Liberties Union filed a friend of the court brief opposing the subpoenas. In making their case that this controversy represented a crisis for academic freedom, Maloney and Makkers and the university itself might have turned to BC staff for support. But by the time the subpoenas arrived, most staff members had soured on the Belfast project. Because of the secrecy surrounding the archive, almost nobody on campus had known about it before the publication of Maloney's book. When it was originally conceived, the project was supposed to have a board of overseers from the university who could monitor its academic rigor. But, like the close reading of the contracts by lawyers, the idea never came to fruition. When the details of the project did come to light, some members of BC's faculty took issue with what they learned. Anthony McIntyre might have had a PhD, but he was hardly a seasoned practitioner of oral history. Nor was Wilson MacArthur. Both men appeared to be ideological fellow travellers, and in some cases close friends with their interview subjects. Hardly a model of academic objectivity. Then there was the fact that Makkers had served nearly 2 decades in prison for murder. Tom Hatchie was regarded with suspicion by the faculty. He was an old friend of President Leahy's, and he seemed to enjoy a sinecure with few actual departmental responsibilities. The same might be said of Bob O'Neill, who presided over the Burns Library. Neither man had a strong scholarly constituency on campus to which he could turn for backup. In an email to Maloney, Hatchie remarked that there was no visible support emerging from outraged academics. Maloney may not have done the project any favours in this regard by endeavouring to bar access by graduate students to the archive. When the Boston College History Department finally released a statement about the Belfast project in 2014, it did so not to come to the defence of academic freedom, but to make clear that the undertaking is not and never was in any way associated with the department. Nobody trusted the integrity of the project, one faculty member explained. Professors in the department believed in academic freedom, but this was such a bad case to hang that principle on. Maloney and Makers brought their case to the First Circuit Court of Appeals and lost. They obtained a stay, which barred the university from handing over the interviews pending an appeal to the Supreme Court. But in the spring of 2013, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case. In determining which of the interviews would fall within the scope of the second subpoena, which requested any material relating to the abduction and murder of Jean McConville, the judge, William Young, had asked Makers for help. For security, each interview had been logged at Boston College without the name of the interview subject and with the alphabet code name instead. But Makers knew the identities of all the people he had interviewed, and he might recall which of them had discussed Jean McConville. He declined to help, however, saying that assisting the court would lead me across the boundary that firewalls academic research from police investigation. Judge Young asked Bob O'Neill for assistance, but he too demurred, claiming that he had not read the interviews. So over several days one Christmas, the judge read through the transcripts of all the Republican interviews himself. He found that six of the participants mentioned Jean McConville, though one had done so only in passing. As a result, Young authorized the release of all the recordings associated with five of the participants. One of those participants was Dolores Price. Makers and Maloney had both been adamant that Price never spoke about McConville in her oral history. Dolores Price did not mention Jean McConville nor talk about what happened to her in her interviews for the Belfast Project, Maloney said in a press release in September 2012. The subject of that unfortunate woman's disappearance was never mentioned, not even once. He wrote in an affidavit that same month. This assertion had significant legal implications, as Maloney explained. The truth is that the interviews that Anthony McIntyre conducted with Dolores Price are notable for the absence of any material that could ever have justified the subpoenas. Technically, this was true. Dolores Price spent some 15 hours in recorded conversations with Makers, and on those recordings, she never once mentioned McConville. But there was another set of recordings in the archives in which Price did discuss the disappearance of Jean McConville in great detail. The interviewer wasn't Anthony McIntyre, however. It was Ed Maloney. When the Irish News reporter Alison Morris went to interview Dolores Price at her home in Malahide in February 2010, the Belfast Project had long since concluded. Makers and Wilson MacArthur had finished the last of their interviews by 2006, and the archive lay in the treasure room at the Burns Library, apparently complete. But not long after Price spoke to Morris, Maloney visited her in Dublin to conduct an interview of his own. What he proposed was not to publish his own version of her story, but to ask her about her past, in a level of detail that would go beyond her conversations with Makers, and then safeguard the interview on the same terms that had applied to the Belfast Project. He would not release her account until after her death. Price agreed. At the time, she was staying at St. Patrick's Hospital, where she was being treated for depression and PTSD. One morning, Maloney visited her there, and the two of them spoke for several hours in her room. Maloney recorded the conversation on a digital recorder. A few days later, they met again, outside the hospital, in a rented flat. This time, Maloney had assembled a small camera crew to film the interview. In both conversations, Price was sober and coherent, her hair tousled and platinum blonde, her eyes lined with mascara. She told Maloney about her Aunt Bridie, about how, when Bridie came home, blinded and maimed after the accident in the IRA arms dump, Granny Dolan had put the house into mourning. Bridie's sisters were not allowed to go out dancing, Price said. It was like having a wake with a living body. It was Bridie's suffering, in part, that had obliged her to join the struggle, she said, because it vindicated her sacrifice. She talked about getting beaten at Burntollet Bridge and joining the IRA and then the unknowns. When Maloney asked about the practice of disappearing people, Price said that she never believed in it. Pat McClure and myself and other volunteers would have discussed it among ourselves, that we didn't know that it was such a smart idea to be doing it this way, she said. But we were told, this is the way it's being done. Do you think it's a war crime? Maloney asked her. I think it's a war crime, yes. I think it's a war crime, she said. I certainly advocated and said that their bodies should be thrown out on the street. To put the fear of God and the Republican movement into anybody who would choose that form of life. Price had already been helping to disappear people for some time when she was ordered to take McConville across the border, she said. Up to that point, she had not known the woman or known of her. But McConville had confessed to being an informer, Price insisted. A transmitter had been discovered at her flat. There was also another detail. Price said that Jean McConville had been spotted by some IRA volunteers at a barracks on Hastings Street. She was concealed behind a blanket with a slit in it that she could see through, Price said. Like the Mau Mau, cloaked in sheets with slits in them so that they could identify their countrymen for Frank Kitson, Jean McConville was, in Price's telling, hiding behind a blanket and picking out IRA men from a lineup. Except that the blanket did not reach all the way to the floor, Price continued, and one of the men recognized the slippers. When McConville was taken for questioning, Price continued, she made an admission. She said that she had been an informer. For money. With a level gaze, Price told Maloney, we believed that informers were the lowest form of human life. They were less than human. Death was too good for them. Along with wee Pat McClure and one other volunteer, Price picked Jean McConville up at a house in West Belfast where she was being held, and they drove towards the border. Price's friend, Joe Linsky, might have known from the moment he got in the car with her that he was being ferried to his death, but Jean McConville had no such premonition. Price told her that she was going to be turned over to the Legion of Mary, a Catholic charity who would take her away to a place of safety. Will my children be brought to me? McConville asked. Price had not realized until that moment she had children. Yes, I'm sure they will, she lied. Will they give me money? McConville asked. Will they get me a house? According to Price, McConville felt no fear, having already confessed everything to the IRA. Along the way they stopped, and Price bought McConville fish and chips and cigarettes. Price told Maloney that she did not like McConville. She said at one point, I knew those Provo bastards wouldn't have the balls to shoot me. And the Provo bastards who were driving her thought, oh, wouldn't they? Price said coldly, adding, she talked too much and condemned herself out of her own mouth. Was this true? It was such a specific recollection, and so starkly at odds with the memories that the McConville children had of their mother. The woman they recalled was not some coarse-tongued instigator, but a cowed and tentative recluse. Could McConville really have lashed out in such a suicidally impetuous manner? When her encounter with Price was so obviously fraught with danger? Was Price consciously lying about the woman? or had she coped with her own sense of culpability by remembering Jean McConville as something less than human? For most of her conversation with Maloney, she maintained her steely resolve, but it could sometimes feel like a pose, a form of armor, and occasionally her tone would falter. "I don't know the specifics of what she did and what she didn't do," Price said immediately after the condemnation of McConville. She had no first-hand knowledge of McConville's alleged crimes. What she knew was that the organization had come to the improbable conclusion that the mother of 10 was an informer. Even if the charge was true, and Price believed that it was, she doubted, deep down, that the penalty was appropriate. "What warrants death?" she said to Maloney. "I have to ask myself, what warrants death?" She continued, "I certainly knew nothing of the nature of the children, or the number. I knew none of that. And had it been a situation where I was brought into the discussion of what happened, I might have advocated a lesser punishment. Perhaps McConville could have been expelled from the country rather than killed," she suggested. "Instead," Price said, "they crossed the border and she left Jean in Dundalk with the local unit of the IRA." "Then what happened?" Maloney asked. "She stayed there for a while," Price said. She hesitated. Then she said, "This is where it gets dangerous for me." If Price continued to malign McConville's character, at least in part, to assuage her own nagging conscience, it may have been because she had done more than simply drive the widow to the border. "I need to know the facts," said Maloney. "Okay, well, we were called back," Price said. She'd been there for about 4 to 5 days, and we were called back to Dundalk. The local unit had dug a hole in the ground. All they had to do was take McConville across a field to the freshly dug grave and shoot her. But they hadn't. "They didn't want to do it," Price said. "It was because McConville was a woman," she thought. "So you guys had to do it," Maloney said. Price said nothing. Just made a small murmur. "Is that right?" he pressed. She murmured again. Then she uttered, "Yeah." "Do you want to talk about that or not?" Maloney asked. "There were 3 members of the Unknowns with McConville when she died," Price said. "Wee Pat McClure, another volunteer, and Price herself. They had only 1 gun, and they worried about their consciences and decided that they would each take a shot so that they could never say for certain who it was that dealt the killing blow. This is an old trick used by firing squads. One of the gunman's rifles will be loaded with a blank so that afterwards each of the shooters can tell himself that he might not have been the one to take a life. It can serve as a comforting fiction, though in this case, because they only had 1 gun, there would not be much ambiguity about which of them did the killing." "We each in turn fired a shot," Price said. "When Price fired hers, she deliberately missed. Then one of the others pulled the trigger, and McConville collapsed." "We left her in the hole," Price said. "Then the local Dundalk unit sealed the grave." "Then you went back to Belfast?" Maloney asked. "Then we went back to Belfast. And what happened then?" "Well," Price said, "we were pretty distraught, and Pat went and reported it." "To Jerry?" Maloney asked. "Yeah," Price said, suddenly shifting his tone from patient confessor to stern cross-examiner. Maloney said, "There's no doubt in your mind, being part of all that operation, that the chain of command was such that the order which had originated with Jerry Adams, yes, Price said, and reporting went back to Jerry Adams. You're sure of that?
I'm sure, she said. Then, her pace quickening, she said,
and he tried to pretend that he was in Long Cash when that happened. He wasn't in Long Cash when that happened. He wasn't, and, that's very hard, a very hard thing. She was upset. Those experiences, I mean... She trailed off. These people do come into my mind. Come into my head, she said.
Linsky, Wright, McKee, McConville. I think about them. And, she continued, I won't tell a lie. I'm not a great one for prayer. But I do occasionally say the odd one in the middle of the night. I do occasionally say, well, God bless them. I hope they are in a better place.
As an IRA volunteer, Price said, I was often required to act contrary to my nature. Sometimes she had to obey orders that were not easy to obey. At the time, she always did as she was instructed. But later, she had the opportunity to ask herself all the complex questions that you don't ask in the heat of the moment. She added, I've spent a lot of time talking to a lot of doctors about all of this. After several hours, Maloney and Price stopped talking. They parted ways, and he assured her that he would protect the things she had said. He would bring the tapes back to America and deposit them in the safest place he knew, the Belfast Project archives, in the treasure room at Boston College. They were still there 3 years later, when two detectives from the Police Service of Northern Ireland flew to Logan Airport in July 2013 and made their way to Chestnut Hill to retrieve the material they had been authorized by Judge Young to collect. The interviews that Maloney conducted with Price were not technically part of the Belfast Project at all, but in trying to keep them safe, he had actually been placing them in jeopardy. Maloney pleaded with Bob O'Neill not to include this material in the collection that the university handed over. The subpoenas were written broadly enough, however, that the university, which had never had much of a fight in it to begin with, chose to give up Maloney's interviews along with everything else. One day, the following spring, Jerry Adams was arrested by the PSNI in relation to the abduction and murder 41 years earlier, of Jean McConville. 28. Death by Misadventure. At Massarine Barracks on Saturday nights, the young British soldiers liked to order pizza. Stuck on the army base, they would telephone a nearby Domino's. Over the course of a given Saturday evening, the Domino's might dispatch 20 different orders to the barracks. The soldiers were good customers. A few minutes before 10 o'clock on the night of the 7th of March 2009, a couple of young soldiers ventured out to the brick gatehouse at the entrance of the base, dressed in desert camouflage. They were scheduled to fly a few hours later in the dead of night on a transport plane to Afghanistan for a 6-month tour of duty. But first, they would fill up on pizza. One delivery car pulled up, and then a second, overlapping orders both from the same Domino's, two different delivery men withdrawing hot square boxes from insulated bags. Then a third car pulled up, a green sedan, and there was a sudden hail of automatic gunfire. There were two gunmen, dressed in dark clothing, their faces hidden by balaclavas. After a sustained initial volley, they approached the two soldiers, who were lying on the ground, and stood above them, firing repeatedly from close range. Having discharged more than 60 rounds in half a minute, the gunmen scrambled back into the green car and disappeared,
the two soldiers were killed. Patrick Azamkar was 21 from North London. Mark Quincy was 23 and from Birmingham. Two other soldiers were wounded in the attack, along with both Domino's delivery men. One of them was a local kid, the other an emigrant from Poland. 12 years had passed since the last British soldier was killed in Northern Ireland. In a phone call to a Dublin newspaper, an armed dissident group, the Real IRA, claimed responsibility. Even the delivery men were legitimate targets, a spokesman from the group asserted, because they were collaborating with the British by serving them. In a statement, the chief constable of the PSNI, Hugh Ord, said, "This was an act by a small group of increasingly desperate people who are determined to drag 99% of this community back to where they don't want to go." A huge investigation was launched and several arrests were made. Then, 8 months after the shooting, a team of heavily armed police officers burst into a house in Andersonstown. Authorities had traced the telephone used by the Real IRA to claim responsibility for the attack. It was a pay-as-you-go phone that had been purchased at a Tesco supermarket in Newton Abbey the day after the shooting. Consulting CCTV footage from the shop, police spotted a pale woman in late middle age who was bundled in a heavy dark coat. As she stood at the checkout and reached into her wallet to purchase the phone, the woman's gaze wandered upward until, suddenly, she was looking directly into the surveillance camera. It was Marion Price. Dolores might have loathed the Good Friday Agreement, but she could not commit herself to any of the Republican splinter groups that were devoted to continuing the violence. Her sister had no such compunction. "Armed struggle does have a place in the present and in the future," Marion would say. She was in her late 50s, with grown daughters and arthritis, but she was not yet ready to put down the gun. After 2 days of interrogation about the barrack shooting, she was released without charge. But 18 months later, she was detained by the authorities again, and this time they did not let her go. Marion was ultimately charged with providing property for the purposes of terrorism. There was another charge as well, relating to a dissident rally in Derry, at which a masked Real IRA man read a statement threatening police officers, saying that as an occupying force, they were liable for execution. While he recited the statement, Marion Price stood beside him, holding his script unmasked. For the next 2 years, Marion was held in prison, including long stretches in solitary confinement. Her psoriasis was acting up, and she started to lose weight. In her head, it could seem at times as if she was back in jail in England, institutionalized again, as if the past 30 years had not actually happened, as if she had never married or had children or enjoyed a life outside prison walls. Dolores was distraught with worry for her sister. She took part in a Free Marion Price campaign outside the prison. Earnest letters were written, and little rallies were held. Supporters described Marion as a victim of psychological torture and internment without trial. It was all conspicuously reminiscent of the movement to free the Price sisters back in the early 1970s. But this campaign did not garner the kind of popular support among Irish Republicans that the Price sisters had enjoyed decades earlier. Marion might not have moved on, but the world had. It had changed in profound and irrevocable ways. The war had taken its toll, and there was a new spirit of compromise and reconciliation in the air. The very month that Marion was taken into custody, Queen Elizabeth II made a state visit to Ireland, the first by a British monarch since 1911, a century earlier, when the whole island was still part of the United Kingdom. a former schoolmate of Dolores's, Mary McAleese, had grown up to become President of Ireland. She welcomed the historic occasion of the royal visit, saying it was absolutely the right moment for us to welcome, onto Irish soil, Her Majesty the Queen. Marion was still in prison the following year when Martin McGuinness, the former Derry gunman turned Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland, met the Queen and shook her hand. McGuinness and Gerry Adams seemed capable of finding common ground with anyone. They even reconciled with the vitriolic Ian Paisley, with whom McGuinness came to work closely in government. In politics, as in life, it is a truism that no one can ever have 100% of what they desire, Paisley said, appearing alongside McGuinness at Stormont. They must make a verdict when they believe they have achieved enough. But just because everybody else was now ready to give up fighting didn't mean that Marion was. She readily acknowledged that her recalcitrance on this matter was fundamentally anti-democratic, that only a tiny minority of people in Northern Ireland were supportive of further bloodshed in the name of expelling the British. But being a Republican isn't about entering a popularity contest, she observed. It never has been. She had announced back in 2001 that another generation is going to have to take up the torch of republicanism and fight on. But whereas she took the torch from her parents, just as they had taken it from theirs, Marion's own daughters, like her sister's sons, showed little inclination to devote themselves to the armed struggle. Marion had raised two civilians, young women who were creatures not of the troubled 20th century, but of the globalized 21st. One of her daughters was a journalist. She worked for the BBC. Some of Marion's friends worried that she was being used by her young dissident associates, that these wannabe revolutionaries humoured her because she was a Price sister, because she conferred as a poster girl of the truly dire years of the struggle some vicarious, if slightly retro, credibility. In 2014, after 2 years in custody, Marion pleaded guilty to both charges against her and was sentenced to 12 months in prison, though due to her declining health and the time she had already served, the judge suspended the sentence. At the hearing, she was frail and approached the dock with the aid of a walking stick. In prison, Marion sustained herself with a cultural diet that seemed less characteristic of a revolutionary agitator than of a middle-brow, apolitical pensioner. She did the word puzzles in the Daily Mail. She read Stieg Larsson novels, and she spent hours watching her favourite TV show, the lush English confection of manor house nostalgia, Downton Abbey. It was about a year after Marion Price was released from custody that her old comrade Gerry Adams found himself under arrest. Armed with the Boston College interviews, the PSNI had already arrested a number of people by that point and questioned them about the abduction and murder of Jean McConville. Some of these individuals had lived in the Divis area at the time McConville was taken, but in 1972, many of them had been teenagers, so if they played any role in the affair, it is likely to have been a minor one. They may have assisted the scrum of locals who removed McConville from her flat that night, and after their interviews with the police, they were all released. Only one person had actually been charged, Ivor Bell, the veteran Republican who, according to Brendan Hughes, had argued that Jean McConville should not be disappeared, but should be killed and left in the street, and who was overruled, in Hughes's telling, by Gerry Adams. Bell faced charges of aiding and abetting the murder, and of IRA membership, because even after the Troubles, you could still be prosecuted for having been a member of a paramilitary organisation in the past. Adams had plenty of notice that the authorities wanted to take him into custody. Since 2011, he He had been a legislator in the Republic of Ireland, so he enjoyed certain courtesies. The police had contacted him in advance through his lawyers and asked him to come to a PSNI station in Antrim. Adams insisted that he would come of his own accord and that they could arrest him inside the barracks. He was, by this stage, an emeritus professor of political optics, and he wanted to deny the police the opportunity to arrest him outside the station, in the car park, where the gaggle of press photographers tipped off in advance could snap a photograph of him in handcuffs. Just after 8 o'clock on a Wednesday evening, 30th of April, Adams glided into the station. His belt, watch and tie were removed, and he was escorted into a room where two officers, a man and a woman, proceeded to inundate him with questions. Given how frequently Adams had been questioned about the fate of the disappeared, you might suppose that he would have a selection of burnished defences at the ready. But the answers that he tended to put forth in these situations were never particularly compelling. Questioned about the oral histories of Brendan Hughes and Dolores Price, Adams tended to repeat his assertion that, because they were aggrieved opponents of the peace process, their accounts must be dismissed in their entirety. He wasn't wrong in suggesting that Hughes and Price nursed grudges. Price herself had once acknowledged that she had given the interviews to Boston College for a kind of score-settling reason. But Adams never seemed to be able to account for how it was that Hughes and Price had independently come up with stories about him that were so identical in their particulars. Yes, they resented Adams, and yes, they had demons, and yes, they were bitter, and yes, that was probably why they put their accusations on the record, Eamon McCann wrote in the Irish Times. But he isn't obviously right in suggesting that these feelings caused them to concoct wicked lies to discredit him. It is at least as likely that they broke the IRA's code of secrecy because they believed it had been rendered meaningless by the strategy adopted by Adams and his close associates. McCann concluded that what they'd been driven to do was not to tell lies, but to tell the truth. As Price herself said, "I wanted very much to put Jerry Adams where he belonged and where he had been." On the particular question of the disappeared, Adams tended to feign a level of ignorance that was difficult to reconcile with the role he had played in Belfast at the dawn of the Troubles. Joe Linsky was a neighbour of mine. He lived across the street, Adams had acknowledged. Yet he had no memory of asking any questions when Linsky abruptly disappeared. There were numerous rumours over the last 40 years, Adams told the Irish News, noting that there had supposedly been sightings of Linsky in Birmingham, Manchester, and Australia. How was Adams to know that the IRA had murdered him and buried him in an unmarked grave? When a Belfast investigative journalist named Dara McIntyre questioned him about Seamus Wright and Kevin McKee, the informants who had disappeared after the Four Square laundry operation, Adams claimed to have known nothing about the IRA's decision to kill them, either. But in his own memoir, Adams had written glowingly about the IRA's discovery of the Four Square Laundry, McIntyre pointed out. How could he have known about that, yet not known that the provost discovered the operation only after Wright and McKee confessed to being double agents? Adams could offer no coherent answer. McIntyre pressed. You weren't at all curious about the fate of these two young men? I learned a long time ago, Adams replied. If you don't ask, you can't tell. Dating as far back, perhaps as his own childhood, Adams had excelled at the fraught art of willful denial. In 2009, a woman named Anya Tyrrell, who was Adams's niece, the daughter of his brother Liam, revealed on a news programme that her father had raped her during her childhood and molested her for almost a decade, beginning when she was 4 years old. In an interview on the program, Jerry Adams admitted that he had known about Anya's allegations and believed them for 22 years. Yet he had never approached the police. In fact, Liam Adams became an active member of Sinn Féin, one who specialised in working with young people. He ended up getting a job counselling local children at a youth centre in Jerry's own Belfast constituency. Jerry would subsequently claim that he had intervened to persuade Liam that this might not be the best environment for him, but by the time he did so, Liam had been in the job for more than a year. Reeling from the exposure that he had long known his brother was a monster, Adams offered a revelation of his own. Their father, Jerry Sr., had been a predator as well, who emotionally, physically, and sexually abused members of the family. Adams said that he had not been abused himself, and he would not specify which of his 9 siblings had been victimized in this way. He maintained, moreover, that he had not known about the abuse until he was an adult. Adams acknowledged that there was a culture of concealment in Irish life regarding the issue of sexual predation. But he was going public now, he said, to help other families who are in the same predicament. On the one hand, this was an astounding turn and a window into how Adams became the cipher that he did. Here was a man who had grown up in a penumbral world of secrets and who had cultivated the quick and unsentimental reflexes of a survivalist. At the same time, some observers detected in this jarring announcement the deft hand of public relations. Anya Tyrrell would later allege that her uncle, whom she called the Beard, had urged her not to go public and had done everything in his power to prevent the revelations about Liam from coming out. When he came forward with his own story of growing up in an abusive household, Adams was breaking, belatedly, a code of silence that had allowed abuse to flourish. But why come forward with the story of his father now, days after the exposure of his brother? As one political journalist in Belfast noted, he must have known, and been advised by his media handlers that it could move the story on from Liam. Adams possessed an uncanny grasp of the metabolism of the news media. The new story would provide a follow-up, give things a new twist, perhaps even attract sympathy for Adams. When he was asked about the disappeared, Adams always flatly denied knowing anything about the decision-making behind this controversial tactic. But it would have been a decision. Even in the antic bloody days of late 1972, the Provos were an assiduously hierarchical organisation in which one didn't go about executing people, much less disappearing them, without authorisation from the brass. Dumping bodies in unmarked graves was not an accident. It was a policy. Dolores Price told Ed Maloney that the decision to disappear someone was made by the Belfast Brigade. The brigade staff would have had to sit and thrash it out, she said, and Jerry Adams was the brigade commander. In the police station at Antrim, the officers asked Adams about the Boston College interviews. Presumably, they walked through the statements by Price and Hughes and others and spelled out what they knew about the structure of the Belfast Brigade. But Adams had a simple, implacable answer to all that. There was just one problem with their theory. He could not have been the commanding officer of the Belfast Brigade in 1972 because he never joined the IRA in the first place. Describing his own theory of how best to survive under interrogation, Adams had once recalled the time he was arrested as a young man and questioned before being locked up on the Maidstone. That was the interview in which he stubbornly insisted that his name was not Jerry Adams. The whole pretense had been an obvious charade. he conceded later, but it was also a crutch to withstand their inquisition. To remain silent was the best policy, he decided as a young man. So even though they knew who I was, it was irrelevant. I couldn't answer their questions on the basis that I wasn't who they said I was. In some other political party, in some other place, the arrest of a politician in a cold case investigation involving the notorious murder and secret burial of a widowed mother of 10 would more than likely mean the swift end of a political career. But Gerry Adams was a special case. Even as Sinn Féin had thrived as a political party, not just in Northern Ireland but in the Republic, and achieved stature and influence beyond the most ambitious imaginings of its leaders, the party's fortunes still seemed tied, inextricably, to those of its charismatic president. Sinn Féin had plenty of young, polished representatives, who, having grown up after the worst of the Troubles were over, bore no compromising taint of paramilitary violence. This new cohort did not lack ambition, but they were unwilling or unable to shuffle the old men of the IRA off the stage. When it emerged that Adams had effectively covered for his paedophile brother, nobody in his party breathed a word in public that was less than supportive. Sinn Féin still retained an unmatched capacity to project the appearance of a unified front, and the leadership now argued that the arrest of Gerry Adams was nothing short of an attack on the party. Overnight, a team of artists painted a new mural on the Falls Road, depicting a smiling Adams alongside the words, "Peacemaker, Leader, Visionary." At a rally to unveil the mural, Martin McGuinness announced that the arrest was politically biased. He cited local government and EU elections in the coming weeks and suggested that the timing of Adams's humiliation was designed to hurt Sinn Féin's electoral prospects. McGuinness blamed an embittered rump of the old RUC that still persisted within the police department and was now out to settle old scores whatever the political cost. With Divis Tower visible in the distance, hundreds of supporters milled around, holding placards that read, "Defend the peace process, release Gerry Adams," above a photo of Adams alongside Nelson Mandela. While McGuinness delivered his remarks, a great bear of a man stood at his elbow. The man had close-cropped grey hair, a high forehead and a knitted brow, and he stood chewing gum, holding the script from which McGuinness was reading. It was Bobby Storey, the IRA enforcer who was known affectionately in Republican circles as Big Bobby. Given all the rhetoric about how Gerry Adams was getting antagonized for being such a peacemaker, Big Bobby was a discordant presence at the occasion. He had joined the IRA as a teenager in the early 1970s and ultimately served 20 years in prison. After the peace process, he had become the chair of Sinn Féin in Belfast, but he was often described as the IRA's top spymaster. In fact, he was reputed to have been the architect of the break-in at the Castlereagh Barracks in 2002. Storey was also widely believed to have been involved in the Northern Bank robbery, in which thieves made off with £26 million. It was the largest bank robbery in the history of the United Kingdom at the time, and it was the timing that proved most significant. The bank was robbed in December 2004, years after the Good Friday Agreement. The IRA no longer needed money to buy weapons. In fact, at the time the robbery happened, the group was giving up its weapons. The decommissioning process overseen by Father Reid was at that point almost complete. For critics of Sinn Féin, the robbery solidified the impression that the IRA had morphed into a mafia organisation. Call me old-fashioned if you like, but there used to be standards, Dolores Price wrote in the aftermath of the robbery. The war is over, we are told. So what is all this money needed for? Big Bobby was a close confidant of Adams's, but he had the mien of a thug. Standing in front of the mural, he took the microphone and bellowed about the arrogance that might prompt authorities to dare touch our party leader. His indignation rising, Story shouted, "We have a message for the British government, the Irish government, for the cabal that's out there." Then he said, "We ain't gone away, you know." To anyone in Belfast who heard those words, the echo was unmistakable. Story was quoting, quite intentionally, one of the most famous soundbites of the Troubles, the moment 19 years earlier when Adams was interrupted during a speech by a heckler who shouted, "Bring back the IRA," and Adams responded, "They haven't gone away, you know." Hearing those words from Big Bobby, Michael McConville felt a chill. The McConville children had been pushing to get access to the Boston College tapes and had felt gratified by the arrest of Jerry Adams. Yet here was what seemed like an unambiguous threat. Mackers, too, saw pure menace in the remark. "He didn't mean Sinn Féin hadn't gone away," he said. "He meant the IRA." To the people who had participated in the Belfast Project, the message was clear. "I don't even care about Sinn Féin and the political process. I don't give a fiddler's fuck," Ricky O'Roa said. "All I care about is the truth." Yet Story was informing those who might dare to tell their tales that they had crossed not only Jerry Adams, but the IRA. To O'Roa, the city suddenly felt unsafe. The IRA itself wouldn't necessarily need to sanction some action against them. With rhetoric like Story's, it could be some kid heeding the call to arms, looking to please the leadership, itching to earn his spurs. A new epithet, Boston College Touts, began to appear in graffiti on buildings around Belfast. In an article titled "The Boston Time Bomb," Sunday World described the state of panic in Republican circles about the Belfast Project and outed a number of additional individuals who had purportedly given interviews to Anthony McIntyre. Mackers has managed to do what countless RUC men failed to do. He has turned good people into touts, one former IRA figure told the paper. Mackers had instructed his children that they should no longer answer any knock at the door and had taken to checking beneath his car for signs of an explosive device. There was a sustained, malicious, untruthful and sinister campaign alleging involvement by me in the killing of Jean McConville, Adams declared when he was released after 4 days of questioning. "I am innocent of any involvement in the abduction, killing or burial of Mrs. McConville." At a press conference, he denounced the allegations against him as a sham and challenged Ed Maloney to explain why he had done the follow-up interview with Dolores Price in 2010. It is that interview, along with the Brendan Hughes and Ivor Bell interviews, which formed the mainstay for my arrest, Adams said. It was important to focus on the future now and not the past, he stressed. "The IRA is gone," Adams insisted, somewhat less than convincingly in light of Story's comments. "It's finished." After releasing Adams, the PSNI forwarded a file on him to the Public Prosecution Service, which would now determine whether enough evidence existed to bring murder charges against them. It looked as though Adams might be in very real jeopardy, a development that, it seems fair to say, Dolores Price would surely have appreciated. But by that time, Price was dead. She had been well aware of the court battle in the United States over her Boston College interview, though she claimed to be indifferent to it. "I've put that away to the back of my head," she said in the summer of 2012. "I will not lose a night's sleep over it." Her drinking intensified, however, as did her depression. The following January, she was briefly hospitalized after falling, drunk, down a flight of stairs. She discharged herself, went back to her house in Malahide, and continued to drink and to take Valium. On the day she died, her son Danny checked in on her before he left the house in the morning and found her in bed, asleep. When he came back that evening, she had not moved. "She wasn't breathing," he said later. "I knew straight away that she was dead." A post-mortem discovered a toxic combination of antidepressants, sedatives, and antipsychotics in her bloodstream. There was no alcohol in her system at the time she died. She was 62. In 1975, when the Price sisters petitioned for compassionate leave from prison to bury their mother, permission was denied. But in 2013, the authorities allowed Marion to leave prison for a few hours so that she could attend the wake of her sister in the family home on Slevgallion Drive. The following day, black flags hung from the lampposts lining Anderson's Town Road as Stephen Ray and his sons carried the coffin through a cold rain and into St. Agnes's Church, trailed by a long cortege. A bespectacled priest with a wreath of white hair said the Requiem Mass. It was Monsignor Raymond Murray, who had been the chaplain at Armagh Jail when Dolores and Marion were prisoners there, and had married Dolores and Stephen in the secret ceremony at the Armagh Cathedral in 1983. In a strange way, she lived up to her name, Dolores, Murray said, a baptismal name given to her, no doubt, in devotional memory of Our Lady of Sorrows. He recalled her early years as a student protester and the lifelong toll of her hunger strike. Her old friend and co-defendant Hugh Feeney was at the Mass. He pointed out that 40 years earlier, he and Jerry Kelly had been on hunger strike along with Dolores and Marion. Now Dolores was being buried. Feeney was at her funeral. Marion was back in prison. And Jerry Kelly was in politics. Kelly, who had become a Sinn Féin politician and had long since fallen out with Price, did not attend the funeral. Nor did Price's old commanding officer, Jerry Adams. Outside, the rain came pouring down. It was a dismal, wind-swept Belfast winter day, and as the mourners left the church and began to trudge to Milltown Cemetery, hundreds of black umbrellas popped open. The coffin was wrapped in a bright tricolour flag, and for a moment it seemed to float, borne along on that dark tide, like a raft on an unquiet sea. We cannot keep pretending. 40 years of cruel war, of loss, of sacrifice, of prison, of inhumanity has not affected each and every one of us in heart and soul and spirit. Price's old friend Bernadette Devlin, who had led the student protests in the 1960s, said, when the mourners reached the grave, "It broke our hearts and it broke our bodies. It changed our perspectives, and it makes every day hard." The other graveside oration was delivered by Eamon McCann. He spoke of Price's contradictions and said that he had loved her for 40 years. If Dolores had a big fault, it was perhaps that she lived out too urgently the ideals to which so many others also purported to be dedicated, McCann said. She was a liberator, but never managed to liberate herself from those ideas. The mourners huddled under their umbrellas as the rain pounded the sodden ground. Sometimes, McCann said, we are imprisoned within ideals. When the coroner asked Dammy Ray if his mother had ever talked about killing herself, he replied that she had expressed no direct intention, but had commented on the self-destructive nature of her condition. The coroner ruled out suicide. There was no letter or note, but Carrie Toomey, who was close to Price in her final years, believed that she had effectively taken her own life. Brendan too, Toomey said, speaking of Hughes. They committed suicide for years. The body is a fantastic machine, Hughes told Mackers in one of his Boston College interviews, recounting the grueling sequence of the hunger strike. It'll eat off all the fat tissue first, then it starts eating away at the muscle to keep your brain alive. Long after Hughes and Price called an end to their strikes and attempted to reintegrate into society, they nursed old grudges and endlessly replayed their worst wartime abominations. In a sense, they never stopped devouring themselves. The official pronouncement in the coroner's report for Dolores Price was death by misadventure. When the graveside orations were finished, the mourners fell silent. There was only the thrum of the driving rain and the distant buzz of a police helicopter hovering in the grey sky overhead. Before the coffin was lowered into the earth, someone retrieved the flag of Ireland, folded the bright rain-soaked fabric, and handed it to Price's sons. 29. This is the past. In the autumn of 2015, Theresa Villiers, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, released a report about paramilitary activity which had been produced by the PSNI and British Intelligence. All the main paramilitary groups operating during the period of the Troubles remain in existence, the report announced, specifying that this included the Provisional IRA. The Provos continued to function, albeit in much reduced form, and still had access to weapons. Big Bobby Story was right. They hadn't gone away. Gerry Adams dismissed the report as nonsense, but it caused a firestorm. One claim Villiers made was that, in the view of rank-and-file Provos, the IRA Army Council, the 7-member leadership body that for decades directed the armed struggle, continued to control not just the IRA, but also Sinn Féin, with an overarching strategy. Secretly, behind the scenes, the army was still calling the shots. The report was careful to indicate that the organisation was no longer engaged in violence, and now had a wholly political focus. Even so, as one columnist in the Irish Times suggested, it seemed to reinforce the notion of men and women in balaclavas running the political show. Nearly 2 decades had passed since the Good Friday Agreement, and Northern Ireland was now peaceful, apart from the occasional dissident attack. Yet the society seemed as divided as ever. The borders between Catholic and Protestant neighbourhoods were still inscribed in the concertina wire and steel of the so-called peace walls that vein the city, like fissures in a block of marble. In fact, there were more peace walls now than there had ever been at the height of the Troubles. These towering structures maintained some degree of calm by physically separating the city's populations, as if they were animals in a zoo. But the walls were still tagged with rune-like slurs, K-A-T, for Kill All Tags, a derogatory term for Catholics, on one side, K-A-H, for Kill All Huns, a reference to Protestants, on the other. The centre of Belfast seemed bustling, almost cosmopolitan. It was dominated by the same chain stores, Waterstones, Cafe Nero, Kiehl's, that you would find in any other prosperous British city. The local film production facility, Titanic Studios, had become famous as the place where the television show Game of Thrones was filmed. There was even a popular tourist attraction, the Troubles Tour, in which ex-combatant taxi drivers guided visitors to flashpoints from the bad years, decoding the ubiquitous murals that conjured famous battles, martyrs, and gunmen. The effect was to make the Troubles seem like a distant history. But the truth was that most residents still lived in neighbourhoods circumscribed by religion, and more than 90% of children in Northern Ireland continued to attend segregated primary schools. Bus stops in some parts of Belfast were informally designated Catholic or Protestant, and people would walk an extra block or two to wait at a stop where they wouldn't fear being hassled. Hundreds of Union Jacks still fluttered in Protestant neighbourhoods, while Catholic areas were often decked out with the tricolour or with Palestinian flags, a gesture of solidarity, but also a signal that even now, many Republicans in the North regarded themselves as an occupied people. For a time, the American diplomat Richard Haass chaired a series of multi-party negotiations about unresolved issues in the peace process. But the talks foundered, in no small measure, over the issue of flags. Tribalism and its trappings remained so potent in Belfast that the various sides could not agree how to govern the display of regalia. When the Belfast City Council voted, in 2012, to limit the number of days that the Union Jack could be raised above City Hall, protesters tried to storm the building, and riots erupted throughout the city, with unionist demonstrators throwing bricks and petrol bombs. In light of this ongoing discord, the Villiers report made one fascinating observation. The existence and cohesion of these paramilitary groups since their ceasefires has played an important role in enabling the transition from extreme violence to political progress, it asserted. This was a counterintuitive finding, and a subtle enough point that it was overlooked in the storm of press coverage that greeted the report. The continued existence of Republican and Loyalist outfits didn't hurt the peace process. It helped it. It was because of the authority conferred by these persisting hierarchies that such groups were able to influence, restrain, and manage their members, the report maintained, noting that there had been only limited indications of dissent to date, which were quickly dealt with by the leadership. To Brendan Hughes or Dolores Price or Marion Price or Anthony McIntyre, Sinn Féin's tendency to brook no opposition seemed self-interested, illiberal, and cruel. But perhaps, as the Villiers report appeared to suggest, it was only through such ruthless discipline and the insistence that Irish republicanism must be